Would you join me in Proverbs, the fifth chapter tonight? Proverbs 5. It's been a month since we were in Proverbs. We had everything from vacation Bible school to youth camp to prayer night, music night. Seemed like everything has hit in a row. But tonight, to get back on track, and I intended to cover, last time we were together, I covered chapter 7. We're actually going in reverse. I intended to cover this chapter actually before chapter 7 and didn't do it inadvertently. I was trying to move along to keep us from getting bogged down, and lo and behold, skipped right over this one. And this one is a very important one, one that I think you'll find very interesting. It is Proverbs chapter 5. Let me read it, and then we will go through it and discuss it. Proverbs 5, verse 1. My son, attend unto my wisdom, and bow thine ear to my understanding, that thou mayest regard discretion, and that thy lips may keep knowledge. For the lips of a strange woman drop as a honeycomb, and her mouth is smoother than oil. But her end is bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword. Her feet go down to death, her steps take hold on hell. Lest thou shouldest ponder the path of life, her ways are movable, unstable is probably a better translation, that thou canst not know them. Hear me now, therefore, O ye children, and depart not from the words of my mouth. Remove thy way far from her, and come not nigh the door of her house, lest thou give thine honor unto others, and thy years unto the cruel. Lest strangers be filled with thy wealth, and thy labors be in the house of a stranger. And thou mourn at the last when thy flesh and thy body are consumed, and say, how have I hated instruction, and my heart despised reproof, and have not obeyed the voice of my teachers, nor inclined mine ear to them that instructed me. I was almost in all evil in the midst of the congregation and assembly. Drink waters out of thine own cistern, and running waters out of thine own well. Let thy fountains be dispersed abroad in the rivers of water in the streets. Let them be only thine own, and not for strangers with thee. Let thy fountain be blessed, and rejoice with the wife of thy youth. Let her be as the loving hind and pleasant roe. Let her breast satisfy thee at all times, and be thou ravished always with her love. And why wilt thou, my son, be ravished with a strange woman, and embrace the bosom of a stranger? For the ways of man are before the eyes of the Lord, and he pondereth all his goings. His own iniquity shall take the wicked himself, and he shall be holden with the cords of his sins. He shall die without instruction, and in the greatness of his folly he shall go astray. If you were here when we talked about Proverbs 7, you probably realized this is very similar. It's like this is the instruction that leads up to what we saw. You recall that in Proverbs 7, it's like he's looking out through the window and seeing a young man turn down towards the house of this alien, strange woman. Well, here we have the instruction that preceded chapter 7, and that's why I didn't want to skip over it. It is a parable in the midst of this section. Let's think about it a minute. Where are we here? We had a preface in the very first verses of chapter 1, and then since then, and we're going to be in this parable of wisdom, I call it, a parable extolling the virtues of wisdom and understanding and instruction. We're going to be in that all the way to the end of chapter 9, and it's easy to get bogged down in all that stuff, and that's why I was hoping that we could move a little faster, but I didn't want to move past this. This is too important. Wisdom, as we have said, is not the same as knowledge. Wisdom is the skillful use of knowledge. It is not just getting the right answer. It is the mindset that gives you the power to arrive at the right answer. It is the paradigm. It's the whole worldview, if you will, that allows you to know and understand how to make the right choices and the right courses of action. We tend to think wisdom is just knowing the answer. No. Wisdom is knowing why that's the right answer and why that's the wrong answer. It allows you to arrive at the right answer. And by nature, wisdom is something that then must be studied. It is not instantaneous. There's no such thing as instantaneous wisdom any more than there's instantaneous proficiency on a piano, or instantaneous proficiency in a sport, or instantaneous attaining to the speaking of a foreign language, as we've used those illustrations over and over now to show you that this is something that takes work, it takes discipline, it takes putting yourself under the tutelage of God as He gives you the principles on which to make sound decisions. Notice that we have the sound of a parent here instructing a child. At first, it sort of sounded like a mother talking to her son, but since the early chapters, it's clearly now a father who is having a heart-to-heart talk with his son. And in verses 1 and 2 of here in chapter 5, we sort of see the reminder here. You see over and over, how many times have we had this now, where there's this thing, don't forget wisdom. In fact, in the other chapter, in chapter 7, he says wisdom is the principal thing. It's the chief thing. You can lose everything else. Don't let this go. This is the thing that you need to major on. Make sure you get this. And so we see the emphasis once again. And what follows in the rest of this chapter is an example of judicious use of wisdom in making the right choices dealing with a strange woman. Now, I've known a lot of strange women in my day, but the word strange here means alien or foreign, and clearly in the context, it seems to be talking about a prostitute. You could say in a more general way, it's talking about an adulteress, and it does involve that, but it is in particular the seduction of a prostitute that is in view. And so we began the meat of this chapter in Proverbs in 5 verses 3 through 6 with a warning. Notice we start off with the fact, do not be deceived. Everything is not as it appears. You'll notice verse 3, the contrast here. It's interesting, again, the structure of the proverb. Notice in verse 3, we have the lips, the mouth, or the of the woman, identified, first of all, as honeycomb. What do you think of when you think of honeycomb? Sweet, okay? And then notice, it's smoother than oil. And when we think of what does oil do to something? Makes it slick. In other words, this is, we talked about Slick Willie over in Arkansas a few years ago. This is slick talking. Anybody ever run into somebody who's slick talking? Well, that's the idea. But notice the parallelism. That's the appearance. She comes across as sweet and smooth, but notice in reality, the next verse tells us that her end, and her end here is the end result, the final destiny. What you reap in the final analysis is not sweet and smooth, it's wormwood, which is bitter and poisonous, and then sharper than a two-edged sword. So her words, which come across in the appearance as smooth and sweet, are in fact poisonous and, well, the two-edged sword is intended to do you in, to run you through. It is cutting. It is, what shall we say, deadly. And so notice the idea between the appearance of the words, the guise, and then the reality that lies behind it. And we'll talk more about that as we sort of make some final conclusions. Her lips are sweet as honey, her mouth slick as oil, and all is designed to attract, to entice, and to pave the way for her agenda. And if she's a prostitute, what is her agenda? I mean, does she love you? Does she care about you? What is she after? She's after your money. This is all a put on. This is all a come on. It's all a disguise for the real agenda that lies underneath it all. In verse 6, we have a rather puzzling verse, I must say. It says, lest thou shouldest ponder the path of life, her ways are, as I say it, unstable or movable, that thou canst not know them. The modern versions all change the thous here in verse 6 to she's, that she ponder the path of her way. Her ways are unstable, that she cannot know them, which doesn't make any more sense. I like the King James rendering here in that it seems to be saying to the young man that if you try to get a handle on her, you'll never be able to do it because there is no handle. Her ways are movable. You say, what do you mean by that? She's constantly shifting. In other words, she is unpredictable. You think you understand her, but you really don't. Does that make sense? Her ways are completely always changing. And so, in other words, the idea is she is constantly coming at you from a new direction. She's devious. She's treacherous. And you will not figure her out. You will never see it coming, put it that way. And so there's the basic warning of to a young man to watch out for the wiles of the seductress. Okay? Y'all awake? I fear you'll be awake tonight. Don't have to worry about things popping to keep you up. This gets pretty raunchy where it's all over. But it's a very heart-to-heart, down-to-earth, very much needed instruction. Realize what's going on behind sexual sin. You need to understand the process. You need to understand where it's heading, where it's taking you, what it's doing to you. Okay? So we start with this very upfront warning. Here's how she comes across. Here's the real agenda behind the scenes. All right. So now we go to another section here of the father telling his son what not to do. And you'll notice in verse 7 and 8, we have sort of a juxtaposition of these two ideas. What are you not to do? Well, you're not to depart from my words, from the words of wisdom. But you are to depart from her. You're to stay away from her, but you're not to stay away from what I'm telling you. Notice the juxtaposition of those two ideas there in verses 7 and 8. Don't let the words of my mouth depart from you, but depart from her. Got the picture? There's the extremes. And you say, well, why not? Because it's going to cost you. Because there is a cost behind the prostitute. Now, that's a no-brainer. She's in it for the money. What she's offering is herself for sale. So it's going to cost you. But notice the monetary cost here is just one aspect, but it is an aspect. And it is something that the father emphasizes to his son. It is going to cost you. It will transfer your wealth from you and yours to the bank account of someone you don't know. Do you see that being emphasized here? Verse 9, lest thou give thine honor. And the honor here used in the sense like we use an honorarium. You're giving your honor unto others and your years unto the cruel. You're giving, you're devoting part of your life to those who really don't care for you. All you are to them is a payday. That's it. They don't have any desire, no matter what the words may indicate or say, they are looking at you as dollar signs. And so, get involved with sexual sin. It's going to cost you. Won't go into details, but in counseling to people who, one fella got hooked on pornography and lost thousands and thousands of dollars in the process. Literally, almost bankrupted him. The transfer of wealth. We could say the same thing with chasing prostitutes. Don't think it doesn't happen. But notice that's just one of the costs. Notice the next thing is the physical cost. Down here in verse 11, he says, lest you mourn at the last when your flesh and your body are consumed. You say, well, what do you think he's talking about? I think he's talking about venereal disease. Certainly, we look back at the looseness of life of the Caesars. Why do you see a Caligula, a Nero, and so forth? My son's theory is that they all were suffering from venereal disease, and that's very likely. Herod, probably the same thing in the way he died. A lot of these Roman rulers are consumed with that. And so notice that not only is it going to affect your money, it's going to affect your health, and that is doubly true in the day in which we live. Not only that, but there's an emotional cost. Down here in verses 12 through 14, we get to the end of our life and we look back and say, what a fool I've been. I hated instruction. How could I have been so blind? I didn't incline my ear to those who were telling me, warning me. And in verse 14, I was almost in all evil in the midst of the congregation in the assembly. I was almost over the cliff, over the brink, too far gone to recover myself. It's sort of an indication that you may still be there. A fascinating thing, by the way, about verse 14, if you're reading this in the Septuagint version, the Greek word for congregation is ecclesia, the church, and the Greek word for assembly is synagogos, the synagogue. And you see how church and synagogue are being used synonymously in the Old Testament to refer to the assembly of Israel. And so, there we go. You're standing on the brink of disaster, the brink of what in this verse 14 seems to indicate that I am in the midst of the congregation of God's people, and I'm in this terrible situation, and I am an utter shame to the name of God. I'm a disgrace to the people of God. And so I'm standing on the edge of utter ruin. So there's the first bit of instruction, and it's what not to do and why. In other words, here's what you're looking at. Here's what's coming. Is a moment of pleasure worth this? That's the question. Okay? No, nobody's helping me out here tonight. You know? I wouldn't help myself out either. Okay, well, that's what not to do. What do you do then? What is the positive side of the instruction? And what follows here is an exaltation of the physical aspect of married life. And it's, in other words, it is rather than doing this, do this. Rather than seeking this, seek this. And notice the elevation of let's just be honest, the physical aspect of married life here. Notice he says, drink waters out of your own system and running waters out of your own well. When we talk about the cistern and the well, we're using euphemisms here. Do you know what a euphemism is? Jeremy, you're nodding your head. Huh? How would you define euphemism? It's a figure of speech, but it's for a certain purpose. What's that? Yeah, that's exactly it. It's sort of like you ladies saying you're going to powder your nose. It's a nice way of talking about something that wouldn't be quite proper to speak of in plain language. Okay? And a euphemism is a way of talking about sensitive things in a discreet way without coming right out saying what you're saying. Okay? You got the picture? And so when we talk of a cistern and a well here in this context, we're describing your wife. On the other hand, when we're talking about the fountain, we're talking about the man, the man's physical aspect of marriage. Okay? I'm helping you through the euphemism here that you get this, that you understand what's being said. Now, he could have said it in very, very raw terms, but he's saying it in a nice, kind, polite way. And so when he says drink from your own well and drink running waters out of your, or drink waters out of your own cistern and running waters out of your own well, what he's saying to the man is get your delight, your satisfaction in marriage, your slake your thirst in your wife. That is God's appointed means for addressing the sexual needs of the male. In other words, rather than simply, this is not a matter of saying, well, I've got to deny that appetite. What he's saying is, here is the God-given way of satisfying that appetite. Drink out of your own well. Now notice the own here. Drink out of your own well, not somebody else's well. Remain in your own territory. This is your well. This is your cistern. Drink out of it. And then the second part of this, verse 16, is very confusing and almost without exception. I could not find an exception. Every version other than the King James Version puts verse 16 in the form of a question. In other words, rather than a statement, let thy fountains be dispersed abroad, it's a question. Should your fountains be dispersed abroad and rivers of water in the streets? Without going into the graphic details here, what he's saying, well, he's basically saying keep your pants zipped. This is private. This is not public. This is not for public dissemination. Do you understand? The husband is not to be out there on the prowl in the public square enjoying every woman that's there. This is keep to your own territory. And should you allow your fountains to water the square? No. The answer is clearly no. Okay? You understand what this is then saying. And that seems to make sense. The reason why verse 16 then is understood as a question, should this happen? The answer is no, because here's the answer in verse 17. Let them, your waters, your fountain, be only thine own and not for strangers with thee. You stay in your own domain for your own situation, your own wife. In other words, what this is saying to you is that there are physical aspects in marriage that are to be kept private between the husband and the wife, and they are for nobody else. And by the way, what you do in your marriage in this regard is basically your business, and it's not anybody else's business. I don't care who tells you what. It's not the preacher's business, not the counselor's business, not your mom and dad's business. It's not for anybody else to know. That's what he's saying. This is private. It's between you and your spouse. Any comments? I didn't think. Yeah, Daryl's got a comment. I'm anxious to hear this. Oh, you're interesting, Daryl, because I've read several of the commentators that pointed out exactly that point, that Solomon was a good preacher, but he didn't practice what he preached, and that it was his strange wives that led him astray. However, to be fair to Solomon, it was not unusual for a potentate in the Eastern world to have numerous wives, and some of those for political alliances of one form or another. David himself had similar marriages along those lines. And in those cases, he was legitimately married to them. In other words, they were his wells, his cisterns, so to speak. They were his domain. What this is speaking of is that someone acting outside the boundary of marriage. Whereas Solomon, for all of his mistakes in marrying all these foreign women, he was married. They were his legitimate wives, if you understand that. That's right. Yeah. In his case, multiply it. But it's interesting, Daryl, that I ran into some of the commentators that made exactly the same observation you're making, that Solomon was good at laying this down, but not very good at following his own counsel here. So there you have the idea of verse 18, let thy fountain be blessed and rejoice with the wife of thy youth. The idea of blessing, well, I won't even go into that. Do you understand that what this is saying is that God is not displeased at physical sexuality within the bounds of marriage? In fact, he encourages it, and basically, notice, the Roman Catholics say that it's only for procreation. The Protestant view has very much descended from that, saying, no, wait a minute, there is an aspect of the physical side of marriage that it means more than just procreation. It is a statement of joy. Notice that's what he's saying here. It is the rejoicing in that relationship. It's enjoying the spouse. And that makes perfect sense. The absurdities that you get led to if only sex is purely for procreation. In this case, it's a celebration of the joy of the marriage relationship. And that's very muchly in the forefront here in this text. It doesn't get any easier, does it? In verse 19, let her be as the loving hind, the pleasant roe. That's the graceful deer. I'm not sure I ever thought of that as a way of describing my admiration for my wife as a graceful deer, but I suppose if that fits your situation, go with it. I don't know exactly how that works. I do understand the next verse, the next part, where it says, let her breast satisfy thee at all times. I'll simply pass along to you what one of my preacher friends passed along to me. He said, some of God's commandments are easier to keep than others. What this is acknowledging is that God has designed the female form to be enticing to the male. It's in the design. I do not know why men are visually turned on and why women aren't. I'm just thankful for it. Because I don't see a man in this room that would be married if it wasn't for that. That little fact. If women looked at men like men look at women, we'd be a hopeless lot. You understand what I'm saying? It is a fact that the female anatomy entices for the male. I mean, that's just the fact. But notice the emphasis here is on the word her. Let her breast satisfy thee at all times. It's the fact that her instead of somebody else's. The someone else's, by the way, is verse 20. Why wilt thou, my son, be ravished with a strange woman, embrace the bosom of a stranger? In other words, satisfy yourself with your wife, not with the stranger. You are given, we have the idea that the grass is always greener on the other side of the fence. No, the grass is always greener wherever you water it. That's where the grass is greener. And the idea is to delight yourself in the wife of your youth. And again, assuming in that culture that most everybody married by the time they were 20, this is the wife of your youth, as opposed to another woman that comes along after the fact. And so the emphasis here is on this fact that we get delight from our spouse and not from someone else. Then the threefold thing here, be thou ravished always with her love. The word ravished here is satiated would be a good translation. Filled, intoxicated, some have suggested. Be intoxicated with her love. Here you have the picture of marital bliss, so to speak, that is offered and is commanded by our God. And yet the problem, as we well know, is that we get to thinking after a while, well, this is boring. And by the way, there's a sense in which, let's be honest. If anybody noticed these Hollywood stars, you know, marrying these beautiful women or beautiful men and beautiful men or handsome men, they rarely last their marriages about 3 years till they get tired, they get bored, even as attractive as they may be, after a while, they're bored, they're tired. They want somebody new. The idea of the novel is going to be better than what I have. True love doesn't work that way. True love seeks to be satisfied with what God has given us and to be intoxicated by the love of a spouse. And so we come then Okay. Delight yourself in your wife and only your wife. That's the father's advice. And we come finally, well, why else should I not do this? Be involved in sexual sin. Notice verse 20 through 23, and especially verse 21, that whatever you may do, and most of the time if a man is seeking a prostitute, at what time of day is it? It's in the night. And you may be able to hide your activities from the eyes of men. But in verse 21, the ways of man are always before the eyes of the Lord. It does not escape God's scrutiny. And verse 22, his own iniquities shall take him. He shall be holden with the cords of his sins. Boy, this is applicable to sexual sin, because it is like the wrapping of a person, binding them with a cord. We could just take even just string and make one pass around you, and you could easily break the string. But as the thing continues and other wraps of the strings occur, to finally, and keep in mind, almost everybody says, hey, I can stop at any time. It's like any other kind of addiction. You know, I can always quit, except you can't. Because what happens is every time it's like another cord bound, and except from the grace of God, he will in fact die. In verse 23, he shall die without instruction, and in the greatness of his folly shall he go astray. It will consume him. It will take him down to hell. Were it not for the grace of God, there would be no hope for someone like this. And so it's like wrapping the body with cords, and the hold gets stronger and stronger and stronger. And so we have a few conclusions here, one of which, if we think back over this proverb, is number one, wisdom demands that you be far-sighted rather than short-sighted. That is the idea that when we can see through the guise, although the words are sweet and slick, we understand the long run here. That's one thing wisdom teaches us. Wisdom demands that you see sexual sin for what it is. And that goes back to those verses about it's a transfer. It's a costly thing. It transfers wealth. It transfers health. It transfers emotionally. It utterly then ends in the destruction, in the death of the victim. Wisdom, on the positive side, demands that you be content with what you have. Owen, in his work on mortification of sin, pointed out that the only way to truly mortify sin is not so much to kill the sin as it is to replace something else in the life that we want more than the sin. I'm not stating that very well. But it's the idea that we keep thinking, well, if I just didn't have this appetite, just didn't have this attraction to sin. What Owen is saying, the way you mortify sin is for something else to enter the life that you want more than you want the sin. And, of course, that's the love of Christ and the love of obedience to Christ. And that suddenly, it's not that the old thing goes away, and that's why the old man is always there with us. But there's a new man that has entered the picture. And I want that more than I want the sin. And that's when we quit sinning. All right? And then wisdom demands that you be God-centered. That's back to this paradigm that wisdom is more than just the right answer. It's the view. It's the paradigm. It's the way you look at things. And notice this proverb ends with the fact that never forget that there's a God in the heavens. You know, you're just thinking it involves you and your lust and this woman. No. There's a God in the heaven who's watching all of this. There's a God in the heaven who is not mocked. So let that be first and foremost in your mind and in your thinking. And as Forrest Gump famously said, that's all I'm going to say about that. Okay? Do you understand why I didn't want to skip this? This is very important, very graphic in some ways, trying to even say it in a nice way. But it's right to the point, and it affects a whole lot more areas than just sexual sin, really. But it certainly hits that one on the head. The idea of what it does to the human soul, to the heart, the dangers that lie ahead, and the fact that we need to be vigilant. We need to be on our toes watching for what's coming. Okay, your turn. Yes, Robert. Brave Robert. Okay. Yes. Exactly. Exactly. And the idea of not turning in the direction of her house is not just physically, but mentally. It's fantasies. It's the thought life of the person that at the first sign, you nip it in the bud. Joseph? Yeah. Joseph, great example of his fleeing. Of course, scriptures tell us flee fornication. That this, in other words, this is noting there are some sins you want to stand and fight, others you want to run from. And this one is one you run from. And that's what the father is telling his son. Don't even go close. Don't even go by her house. And that's why then Proverbs 7, when he's looking out through the window and he sees the simple son come down the street and suddenly make a turn down towards the prostitute's house, he's saying that's the first step. That's the first step in that direction. Now, the second thing that needs to be kept in mind, we ought to cut it off at the first step. What if you didn't? We have this notion, well, to lust after a woman is the same as committing adultery with her, so we might as well just commit adultery. No, never, ever think in those terms. Again, the sin itself is sin, and it's damnable sin, it's horrible sin, but the consequences of sin get worse and worse and worse the further down this road you go. Don't you think David wished that he had never gone up on that rooftop that night? The time is all over. In other words, the consequences are so grave. The sword never left his house as a result. Yeah, it shows a lack of understanding the danger. And David was basically doing what any Eastern king would have done. Sees a woman he wants, he takes her. Except David had a king over him who didn't see it that way. Other comments? You do know we live in a erotically charged culture. Oh, I tell you what, I think back in 50 years or so of things on TV. And I'm not talking about the shows, I'm talking about commercials. I mean, stuff that you would not have even spoken of in proper society 50 years ago is blatantly blaring there in the commercial, let alone the show. So we are bombarded by this kind of thing. Daryl? Yes. I'm at the car show. Here's the lady in the bikini standing there showing off the car. I'm sure she's a engineer, knows all about automotives, you know. That's why they've got her there, because her brain. Yeah, uh-huh. And the problem is it works. Well, at least with men, and I think with women as well, to some degree. In other words, it gets your attention. Maybe not in the same way, but it does get your attention. And that's what they know. That's what they're counting on.